In the coming week, supply chain challenges reverberate again. High-stakes diplomacy continues with Russia over Ukraine, and Hondurans inaugurate a new president. It's January 20th, 2022, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Shannon O'Neill, sitting in for Jim Lindsay.
Shannon, as many of you may know, is CFR's Vice President, Deputy Director of Studies, Nelson and David Rockefeller Senior Fellow for Latin America Studies, and a favorite guest co-host on The World Next Week. Shannon, as always, a pleasure forecasting with you.
It's always fun for me, too, so I'm looking forward to it again, Bob.
All right, well, let's get right into one of the gnarly issues that you like to study closely, which is global supply chains. More specifically, the ongoing pandemic-era problem with global supply chain issues. We have China now imposing new COVID-19 restrictions that has given concern in lots of places, including American manufacturers who are worried that the already slow supply chains might get even slower and what the knock-on effects will be. Now, Shannon, you wrote in last month's Foreign Affairs about the issue of supply chain breakdowns and also the role of governments in maybe even further muddying this situation. Could you break down what's going on here and what we need to know about the current slowdown?
Sure. So if we look back at 2021, the biggest challenge for supply chains and the delays that we saw was really a demand surge. So Americans who were sitting at home bought almost $1 trillion more worth of goods than they did in 2019 before the pandemic hit. And lots of those goods, whether they were computers or furniture or home appliances or construction materials to fix up your house, a lot of those came from all over the world. And that really put a stress on supply chains.
So these are all those delivery trucks I'm seeing from Amazon and FedEx and things in my neighborhood, Shannon?
Exactly. All of those packages and all of those ships that are backed up at Los Angeles and Long Beach port off of California, carrying lots of that stuff. And in fact, we saw exports from China to the United States rise by almost a third, satisfying that demand that came from the United States. But as we look into 2022, I would say, at least so far, now we're almost in the second half of January here, the biggest challenge and stress may be supply constraints. And that's exactly what you just opened up with, which is Omicron and COVID hitting China in a way that it really hasn't since the very first days of the pandemic. So as we all know, Omicron is much more contagious than some of these previous variants. There's real questions about whether the Chinese vaccine that so many Chinese have taken really works against Omicron. It's not an mRNA vaccine. It's an old school vaccine. And so there's a real question about whether it's efficacious, if it really works to protect the Chinese. And then China's taken a very different path in terms of dealing with COVID than most other countries around the world, which is what they're calling a zero COVID policy, which they're really trying to stamp it out, not just manage it, not just manage the illness, but stamp it out. So as this more contagious variant sweeps across China, you see it picking up in lots of different places, and China has locked down cities and different parts and provinces as a result. So that is leading to supply constraints across a whole bunch of ways. So one is it's just shutting down factories themselves, right? Because parts of cities are shut down and factories are within them. So for apparel, for automotive things, for electronics, you're seeing shutdowns of factories. Another issue is the movement of labor. Lots of Chinese move to those cities to work in those factories and then go back at various points of time during the year, particularly right now as Chinese New Year, Lunar New Year is coming up. So it's stopping the movement of people back and forth that might populate factories, even if those factories are still open. And then finally, you've seen China really double down on closing off its borders as Omicron has come in. So the number of flights that are going in and out of China to the United States, to Germany, to Europe have dwindled significantly. You're seeing border closing. So for instance, Vietnamese food producers are unable to get their fruits and vegetables into China because you're closing the borders or slowing the movement in and out because of these worries about Omicron. So you're seeing overall real supply constraints in China itself, which is affecting Chinese, but it is also will probably reverberate through these global supply chains and hit the United States as we look forward in the next several weeks and months.
How much, Shannon, do we tie the now sort of monthly tote of inflation, rising inflation, to this phenomenon? Is this something that there's a direct or it's a bundle of issues that are contributing to that? Or how should we look at that?
It is a bundle of issues, but I do think the challenges of supply chains are a big part of it. So it really is a driving factor. It is that there are shortages and people want those goods. And so when you have too little of something that has a lot of demand, prices go up. So it is a big part. There's lots of other factors that we know, labor issues are part of it. Expectations are another part of it. There's other things there. There's energy issues that are definitely a big part of it. But this is a big issue. And while part of it has been this demand surge, as we look forward, I do think think it's going to be a challenge on the supply side. So, you know, as we think about inflation and you know, how to tackle it, this is going to be a big issue. And it's not one that's really easily solved by monetary policy in raising interest rates, because you just don't have the supply. That's the challenge as we go forward.
Yeah, I was going to get at the solving question then. Do we know anything that about how suppliers have maybe learned a few things or tried some new things out in the last couple of years in terms of diversifying sourcing, or the, you know, changing their so-called just-in-time approach to providing everything from auto parts to clothing and other things that you mentioned?
We've definitely seen changes for sure, right? And some of that has made it, while we focus in on the challenges to supply chains and the parts of the shelves that are empty, or that back order on the holiday present that never came to your house, more goods than not make it in. And what's actually been impressive is that the U.S. logistics system has handled a record number of packages. All those you know, vans that are showing up and going up and down your street, but all of those ships that are coming to the ports, they've handled a record number of containers and ships and railroad cars and all of, they've handled all of this. So have there been shortages? Yes, but they've done so much more than they did pre-pandemic. So I think we have to look at it sort of glass half full, glass half empty as to how the U.S. and how companies have responded. We've definitely seen companies change sometimes where they source things. That's true. We've seen them order a little bit more so that they can have more in inventory if things don't come in quite as fast. That's also true. We have seen them sometimes look for sources in other countries. So if one country shuts down, as we've seen over this long slog of the last 2 years with COVID, they, you know, try to find other places that are still open that might be able to manage or sell or produce the kinds of things that they need to go into their products. We've started to see a little bit of regionalization. So bringing things a little bit closer, maybe it's not all the way home in producing things, but a little bit closer so that you have supply chains that don't produce quite as much, but are parallel to others around the world. But I would say, as companies go out there and they look around and they think about how to do this best, the supply chains over the last 2 years have, on the whole, actually really held up and been much more resilient than some of the headlines might tell you. There is a question, though, because so much of it over this last 18 months to 2 years has come to depend more rather than less on China, whether that calculation will continue. And I think this, you know, beginning of Omicron and sort of how the pandemic plays out there in the first half of 2022 for China will test some of these supply chains and the, you know, the satisfaction that some companies and executives have felt actually with the performance of their companies, if it hits harder than it has so far. So we will see. This is something that, you know, to be determined as we go forward, if we still have the global supply chains for all the commercial goods that everyone still seems to want a lot of.
You know, if nothing else, people are learning, just the average folk are learning about the ways of global commerce a little bit more than they thought. I've never heard the term global supply chain mentioned so much in regular conversation as I have in the last several months.
That is true. And I will venture to guess you're still going to hear it in 2022. It's not going away anytime soon. So keep your eyes out for them.
And I'll hold on to that used car for a little bit longer, too, I think.
I think that's a good idea as well. Yeah, semiconductors are going to take a little bit of time to work through all of this, and cars are really dependent on it. That's been one of the big challenges. But Bob, let's turn our attention to another issue, another big global geopolitical issue, and that is what's happening on the Ukraine-Russian border. The world has been anxiously looking and watching what has become a very fast-moving, incredibly tense situation that's happening there. We saw just yesterday the Biden administration announced that it is going to provide an additional $200 million in defensive military aid to the Ukrainian government as the worries about a Russian invasion increase just by the hour. So catch us up a little bit on what is going on and what the situation is happening, both the Ukrainian side, the Russian side, European side, the US side. And, you know, are we really on the precipice of war here?
That is the question of the moment, Shannon. And I should note, as we're taping this podcast, there is what U.S. officials are referring to as some sort of last-ditch diplomacy going on in Europe. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, I believe, is in Berlin today. He was in Kiev yesterday. Tomorrow, he'll be in Geneva meeting with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. And I should say, again, this is, the U.S. is couching this as last-ditch. Russia is also saying that time is running out, but they are not saying why it's running out. They are continuing to sort of defer and dismiss indications of any sort of Russian invasion of Ukraine, although it's all the signs are that that is imminent. There is a great deal of satellite footage of Russian forces. Most recently, there have been a number of Russian troops and material going into Belarus for what is supposed to be war games, but war games that are taking place within 10 miles of the Ukrainian border. So that's raising concern. And you know, there's also the memory of the annexation of Crimea from 2014 and the ongoing Russian support for separatists in the Donbas region of Ukraine. Ukraine. So lest we forget, there is actually a Russian supported, you know, war going on in eastern Ukraine. This would be a major ratcheting up if it took place. And so we just had a press conference with U.S. President Joe Biden basically telling reporters that he doesn't think Russian President Vladimir Putin wants a full-blown war, but there could be some sort of incursion. And then Biden raised the question of whether or not, you know, that incursion would carry with it a severe response or not from the U.S. Biden administration followed up quickly saying any Russian incursion would face the stiffest costs and so forth. So we'll have to see what that part of the equation is going to be. But again, it's still this question of, is there anything that can be said in diplomacy at this point that is going to move this away from or de-escalate this whole process away from what has been sort of a zero-sum process? Russia saying, in essence, the U.S. and NATO have to affirmatively come out and say Ukraine will never be part of NATO, that it will not stage any NATO forces in former Soviet republics, and basically take a whole number of steps that will indicate to Russia that there is no threat and no reason to feel a threat from NATO. On the U.S. side, on the NATO side, they are saying this is a manufactured crisis, that NATO has never posed a threat to Russia, and that Russia is setting out demands of a sovereign country that cannot be accepted. And so we're going to have to see what, if there's some sort of new formula going on that we don't know about, Jen, and that can allow them to back away and find some common ground to ensure some sense of restored, let's say, confidence or confidence in a process that will de-escalate the situation. Because it seems there's this sense of doom and inevitability about what may be transpiring in Ukraine.
Well, it seems like at least what's on the table, the public table so far, is a non-starter in terms of getting to some sort of compromise. So if we can't get there and Russia does invade, how might the United States respond?
Well, you mentioned in the intro to this discussion about the support for Ukraine. So I think we'll continue to see support that will allow Ukraine to defend itself. And we'll see what sort of speed, if there is a Russian invasion, how quickly it moves and how quickly it maybe throttles Ukraine and how much support may be helpful or not. We'll have to just see how that part plays out. But then there's the penalties of sanctions. First of all, the United States has already taken off the table early on that it will get involved militarily directly in this, in any dispute. But it has continued to hold out the prospect of really severe financial costs and sanctions. For one thing, the U.S. and some Western governments are considering cutting Russia off from the SWIFT global payment system, a transaction process in which Russian goods and Russian payments can be made in a way that the international system accepts and moves expeditiously through. That looks like it could be in jeopardy, although some countries have balked at taking that step. There is also still talk about slowing down the Nord Stream 2 energy pipeline between Russia and Germany. Germany itself has slowed down the process by setting in place some regulatory checks that could slow it further. There's a new German government in place, and they have raised their concern about Russian threats to security in the region as well. So we'll just have to see whether there is a stiffness and a collective will among the U.S. and its allies to make Russia pay for this. I should note one more thing, Shannon, which was you had a recent address by French President Emmanuel Macron to the European Parliament talking about Europe needing to generate its own set of security steps, sort of separate from a U.S.-led security environment. It raised a lot of questions about whether or not Macron was planning some sort of separate front, whether it vis-a-vis Russia or other issues, and whether or not Europe was going to even come up with its own sort of security force and so forth. That remains to be seen. This is also an election year for France. There's elections in April. Some analysts have said that Macron was sort of posturing regarding France's own place in leading a new revived European security. We should also note that Macron had called NATO not too long ago brain dead. So he has his concerns about NATO. But at the same time, a number of experts have said NATO is actually being given a new kind of boost of purpose by the threats posed by Russia.
I did know that Brussels officials responded very quickly to Macron's proposal and said that that's not on the table. So we will see where that lays out. You know, one issue, it seems to me, in the divide potentially between the United States and Europe on this is how dependent Europe is on Russian gas. And we have seen gas prices all around Europe and the UK skyrocket this winter. There's real challenges there and almost a crisis in sort of the energy side of things. And, you know, if we see Russia invade, if we see sanctions against Russia, energy prices around the world are going to go up. There'll be a real destabilization in gas markets, but then also potentially in oil markets. So I think this is, as we talked about inflation earlier, this is going to be a big issue that will reverberate much further than Europe. Though Europe will be at the center of it in terms of paying the costs if we see an incursion.
No, it's a really good point, Shannon. The only other thing I would add on that front is there have been some reports that there are intensified talks between U.S. and European officials over the U.S. stepping in and sort of stepping up its supply of, let's say, natural gas to Europe to try to make up for any shortfall. Either the sequencing of that is not clear, but it is something that's been out there. It's something actually previous President Donald Trump had talked about doing more of as well. But still in all, the amount of energy that Europe gets from Russia and parts of Europe, some parts more than others, really rely on it. It is a real chief consideration as well. And it's also, I think, part of the calculation that Vladimir Putin has made in terms of posturing the way he is. He's faced penalties and he's faced, and close supporters of him have faced, you know, what so-called smart sanctions in response to the annexation of Crimea that has seemed to little bother them. But, you know, and Ukraine, as he has repeatedly said, is an integral part of Russian culture and really part of Russia, let's face it. And so his top aides have increasingly talked about Ukraine and other former Eastern Bloc countries as sort of orphans after the fall of the Soviet Union, in a way sort of denying them their own sovereign decisions, and Ukraine especially its own sovereign decisions now almost 30 years as an independent state. And so this gives you a sense of the mindset of Russia, but also back to our original discussion, you know, how imminent really is some sort of a Russian move here? It is not clear. And it really, a lot of it, as President Biden said yesterday, resides in Putin's mind.
I would say the Ukrainians beg to differ that they are part of Russia.
Yes. And don't refer to it as the Ukraine, by the way. You will get a very strong response. So
noted.
Shannon, I'd like to take our discussion to Latin America. Before the new year, you and I sat down with Jim Lindsay for a special year-end podcast in which we discussed many of the elections on the horizon in Latin America in 2022. In the coming week, Hondurans are set to inaugurate Xiomara Castro, a left-leaning politician and the country's first woman president. So tell us what we need to know about Xiomara, Shannon, and what this transfer of power could mean for Honduras and the region.
So this election turned out to be a real referendum on the ruling party that had been in power for 12 years in Honduras, and actually whose allies had kicked out Castro's husband in a coup, who had been in power, Miguel Zelaya, back in 2009. So it was a real transfer of power within Honduras. And it's also important because you saw such a huge turnout. Two out of every three voters in Honduras came out to vote. And they came out to vote despite violence that surrounded some of the elections and some assassinations of opposition candidates. They came out despite misinformation, particularly by the government and the ruling party, to try to dampen down the voters and people coming to the ballot. And so I think it really is a win for democracy in Latin America. And that is quite important. And if you look at Honduras over the last, you know, 10 to 12 years and what has happened under the National Party, under this ruling party, it is a place that has been riddled by violence. It has been riddled by corruption. The ruling party is very closely tied with narco trafficking. And in fact, the current outgoing president's brother was convicted in U.S. courts for trafficking of drugs into the United States. And it is a situation, a very bleak situation in Honduras over the last decade plus, that has led one out of every nine Hondurans to leave their country, to migrate. So I think, one, this is a really important election because it made sure that democracy still worked and that you couldn't steal an election or overturn an election just because you're in power. And two, it provides hope, even if a small sliver of hope, given all the challenges Honduras faces, that things can get better for the average Honduran, that they have a choice and that they can elect a new government when the previous government was really failing them.
Shannon, let's bring it back to U.S. interests for starters. Is this something in which we might start seeing the new administration reaching out to the Biden administration about some of the gestures and indicators made that, you know, Honduras could get some U.S. support for keeping its own house in order and keeping people in Honduras to sort of cut down on the outflow towards the United States?
I do think it opens up a space for partnership. And interestingly, when Vice President Harris had gone down to talk with Central American leaders in this past year, she did not go to Honduras, in part because the sitting president has such a storied reputation, and along with his brother, you know, in terms of the real challenges of the region. We see that actually the inauguration, which is coming up, we see a whole delegation from the United States, including the vice president, who's going to go. And so I think there is a lot of space there for cooperation and for some back and forth and for USAID, for other kinds of, you know, Samantha Powers, the head of USAID, is also going to the inauguration. So you already see on the diplomatic side, this suggestion of working together. You know, one of the initiatives that incoming President Castro talked talked about in her campaign trail was that she wanted to bring to Honduras a UN-led anti-corruption agency, the like that we've seen in Guatemala in the past. It was called CICIG in Guatemala, but bring a similar one to Honduras to help her clean up some of the corruption issues. Now, this is not an easy road to go down and really something that you have to think about over the medium and really long term. But I think even opening up, that's something too that's very appealing to the Biden administration and something that it's talked about doing in various areas to help strengthen the rule of law in countries that have had real challenges.
I think back to your initial comment, Shannon, the surprise of this election raises hopes that maybe, you know, all is not lost in the region. And obviously, Central America is not a monolith, but, you know, we've talked about it as the Northern Triangle, the troubled Northern Triangle countries of Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. If Honduras is able to start getting on the right path, whether or not it's an anti-corruption commission set in place or other things, do we see any hope for this to be kind of crossing borders in terms of this sense of, you know, the countries, people can take back their country a little bit, whether it starts at the ballot box or not?
I don't think we want to get too excited right away that this is it and we're on a new path.
Getting ahead of myself, I know.
We're getting ahead of ourselves, yeah. Because she faces a very divided Congress. So her party has, you know, the coalition on the left will be a fractious one and not enough to get through real serious major reforms. We have seen the outgoing president put in some decrees that will keep many of his loyalists in the bureaucracy. So it'll be hard to change those, you know, levers of government and clean it out as one might hope. And, you know, there's other challenges just in Honduras. After so many years of difficulties and lack of economic opportunity and violence and worries about security forces and police forces not doing what they should do, protect, you know, the citizens, but actually be involved with some of the criminality that is in Honduras. There's all of these huge challenges. But I do think it provides at least that first step to potentially taking them on. And in some ways, actually bringing not just government levers and apparatus, but opening up to broader civil society and private sector and business and others who might want to create a different Honduras down the road. So I think, you know, as economists would say, it's a necessary but not sufficient condition, right? You at least needed a change at the leadership to even provide any opening for a different kind of Honduras than we've seen over the last decade. So that is hope, but it doesn't mean that you're going to make it down this path. I do think, as we were just talking about, it opens up a space, though, for the United States to really engage with this government and help it where it sees an opportunity, which it did not have with the previous government, to be sure.
And also, as you have written about before as well, you can't dismiss the prospect for what elections could bring throughout Latin America. Look what happened in Chile recently, raising some hope there, again, with the proper reality checks, too.
I do think it's important. And as we look throughout Latin America, you know, there's lots of articles that have been written about the return of the Latin American left and whether some people support that, some people don't support that. I would say, I think this election, I think Chile's elections, I think others should give us pause in painting that broad brush stroke in terms of what the left is. And I think there's all kinds of presidents that are put under that leftist rubric. Some are sort of ideological authoritarian types. You know, those would be the Maduros or the, you know, in Cuba, the Castros and the like. Some are populist leftists who want to spend a lot of money. And, you know, you see that in various places. And some are newer lefts that care about the environment, care about social issues and the like. And sometimes there's a mix of all of those factors within. But I think it's important as we look to some of these elections. You mentioned Chile, which is a critical election. We have here in Honduras. Yes, they come from the left of the political spectrum, but they're very different animals and they're very different types of politicians. And I think for the international community writ large, but the United States in particular, finding the ones that we think we can work with. And I think, you know, at least so far, Castro in Honduras has presented herself as a social democrat, right? As someone who cares about democracy, you know, and small d, supporting institutions, that cares about, you know, spreading the wealth, being more inclusive, but doesn't yet, it seems, we'll find out, have those tendencies or at least in her campaign, not those aspirations for economic populism, nor sort of the more authoritarian bent. You know, you're either with us or against us. But you know what? As we all know, these political realms are complicated, they're messy. And just because, you know, a politician says something in one field doesn't mean that they actually act that way. So, you know, the proof is once she gets governing, if she can pull together a quite fractious coalition that comes from that progressive side and keep some of the more, you know, there are some less than savory tendencies all across the political spectrum in Honduras. And so can she avoid them? Can she keep them in check? And can she not fall prey to that herself? That's what's really remained to be seen. But I do think we should celebrate that democracy worked. The this time in Honduras and wish the best for that nation because it matters for everybody in the region, including the United States.
All right. So we'll take small steps, but there's an inauguration of hope at least.
Exactly. Well, Bob, I think it is time to pivot and to discuss our audience figure of the week. And this is where listeners can vote on or tweet at us at CFR_org. And this week, Bob, our audience has selected the Tonga volcano eruption as the figure of the week. So tell us what happened.
Well, Shannon, our audience was, I think, riveted like many others by what transpired over the course of last weekend. They're calling it the largest such eruption, largest explosion by a volcano in almost 30 years. Back to what some people might recall the Philippines volcano of Mount Pinatubo, among others. There's still ash spewing out into the sky up to 12 miles high. The islands that make up Tonga are many of which are covered in ash at this point. It is a disaster for that archipelago nation, but it's had all sorts of reverberations. And it's still, at the very least, it shows the world that, you know, there are things that go on this planet geologically that we still have little understanding of and still are trying to learn about. And this is one of them. So you had this eruption followed by a separate eruption and then the spewing out of ash and cloud. You had it triggering a tsunami that actually, some of which reached as far as the coast of Oregon, United States. You showed there were images over the weekend of water lapping up much higher than it had. Luckily, it was no sort of devastating tsunami like we had seen in the Indian Ocean more than a decade ago. But it sort of was a test of the tsunami system in throughout the Pacific Rim, and it seems to have responded well. Now it's a question of, you know, a truly complex emergency in terms of trying to get help to Tonga. It's hard to actually have communication because an underwater internet connection was severed in the explosion. You have nearby major nations or big nations like New Zealand and Australia trying to help, both in sending in aid, but also in communicating. But you also have the concern about COVID spread. So there are early precautions taken in which you have supply ships showing up, dropping off their cargo, and then taking off. Tonga has only had apparently one recorded case of COVID since the pandemic broke out. It's a nation of about 100,000 people, and they're spread over 30 or so islands. And so they don't want this to be a multi-layered crisis emerging from this volcano. So they're trying to keep COVID at bay, but they also need aid. They need drinking water. They need food. And then a sense of how they're going to kind of put the pieces together while you still have the sort of the spewing out of this volcanic eruption. One thing that should be noted, there was some speculation that given the size of the eruption, you know, could this be one of these events that actually sets in motion a process that might even slow or reverse global warming to some extent? Some experts are saying, no, it's not going to go that far. But it is worth noting that some volcanic explosions in the past have been so great that they have played such a role. So it's just one of these big planetary moments that it gives people kind of pause, I think, Shannon. And now I think there is a genuine desire to try to help out the Tongans.
Yeah, it sounds like a difficult being. They're isolated, which helped them in COVID, but now they're even more isolated. And I think that a huge challenge and a real sadness for those communities, such a tragedy for those communities.
Yeah, very much so. And so again, it's a Polynesian nation. It's an archipelago and it's very remote, but it's another test for sort of the regional and international system and how they can respond.
Indeed. Well, maybe this is an area we're always searching for, an area where lots of big nations can find cooperation and work together. Perhaps Tonga is a place that can bring some of these at times rivals together. We'll see, I guess, right?
That's correct. Hope to talk about Tonga again in a nicer light, Shannon.
Indeed. Bob, that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories that you should all be keeping your eye on. There's a presidential election that will take place in Italy. The World Health Organization Executive Board will meet in Geneva. And the Bolivian president, Luis Arce, will address the nation on the Plurinational State Day. This is an annual celebration of the adoption of the new constitution that they put in place in 2009.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And leave a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. By the way, any articles or podcasts mentioned in this episode are listed on the podcast page for The World Next Week on CFR.org. Please note that opinions expressed on The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Shirley. Zoe also doubled as our recording engineer. Thanks, Zoe. Special thanks to Margaret Gatch, Chloe Mauvais, and Rafaela Seward for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons.
This is Shannon O'Neill saying goodbye.
Shannon, thanks so much for joining us. This is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay healthy out there.